I thought what we'd do today is continue on by taking another book of the Bible and going through it. How far we'll get, of course, is interesting. So we'll take the book of James. It's held, please, to James. A very interesting book. Martin Luther called it an epistle of straw. He couldn't see anything worthwhile in it at all. It wasn't spiritual enough for him. So let's see what the Apostle James has got to say. James, chapter 1, verse 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes that are scattered abroad, greetings. That in itself probably is worthy of a sermon. But let's go straight into verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations or diverse trials, various trials, different kinds of trials. Now the word joy is interesting here. I thought there must be a bit of a trick here. So I looked up the word joy. But it's the same word that Christ used just before his crucifixion when he said, my joy I leave with you. It's the same word all through the New Testament. And what it means is calm delight or cheerfulness or exceeding gladness. Now, a few weeks ago, Mr. Bowles mentioned about the man who fell down the well. And this picture stuck in my mind. And here we are, a trial, right? So you've fallen down the well. You're dangling about 50 or 60 feet above the water, and this jagged rock sticking up through the water. And the rope that you're clinging onto is starting to fray. You can hear the little strands twinging and twanging. And somebody calls down from the top, I'm coming to help you. And you say, no, no, leave me alone. I'm having a trial. It's fantastic. I don't want anybody to spoil it. Lucky me. I think not. So what does this mean? Well, first of all, if you were dangling from that rope, you would be praying rather fervently. So let's look at some of the great men of the Bible, because they had trials, and they were recorded for us. So what can we actually learn from them? So first of all, we'll have a look at Job. Now, I'm starting with Job for the simple reason that Job is a rather peculiar book. It's written in very ancient Hebrew. We don't know when it was written. We don't even know properly where Job actually lived, what time he lived in the Bible. Mr. Armstrong felt that he built the Great Pyramid. And there is now evidence that somebody has noticed, which of course is totally rejected by the authorities, as Mr. Munro just pointed out, that all around the Sphinx and all around the Great Pyramid at Giza, there are very obvious signs of serious water erosion. So the pyramid could well possibly be pre-flood. So I thought we'd deal with Job first anyway, because he does actually fit into the story, as you'll see. Mr. Armstrong, as I say, mentioned several places that he quite possibly built the Great Pyramid. So we're not dealing with an ordinary man, shall we say. We're dealing with somebody rather special. And Ezekiel, make a note of Ezekiel 14, verse 14, because this is what is recorded about Noah. It says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should not deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the eternal God. So Job is lumped together with Noah and with Daniel, which is rather interesting. Job was probably the wealthiest and greatest man of the East. You find that in Job 1, verse 3. He was a noted builder. Again, if you wanted to just make a note, Job 3:13 and 14, and compare that with God's challenge to Job in Job 38, verses 4 to 6. It refers to building. He was so upright and perfect, God even dared Satan to find a flaw with his character. But of course, there was a flaw. And the main flaw was self-righteousness. But of course, he had other flaws as well. But it all ties in with self-righteousness. Here is a man who was so great that when he fell into this awesome trial, who came to his aid? Who came to reason with him? Three men. In some Bibles, they're called kings. In other, they're called great men. He wasn't dealing with the riffraff of society. He was dealing with people at the very top. This is the kind of people he dealt with. He was obviously very well educated, because when God challenged him, he said, can you move the Pleiades? Now, that would have been inferred that Job understood all about the stars and astronomy. And of course, if he built the pyramid, he would have to, because it's aligned, evidently, with the stars. He was filthy rich. make Bill Gates look like a pauper. Right? He had a terrific family. He had everything going. He had honor and glory among the people. He had status. But look what he said. Turn to Job 3, verse 25. Job 3, 25. Because here we start to see the flaws creeping in. Because self-righteousness is self. It's always inward. It's looking at. He felt he was righteous because of all the wonderful things he'd done. And he had done pretty fantastic things. That pyramid at Giza is a wonder to behold. And put 5 million bricks, all weighing 5 tons or something, transported for hundreds of miles and put together so close you can't put a piece of tissue paper between them, and it's still standing after all these years. Quite a monument. Job 3:25, though, here's the interesting thing. He says, "For the thing which I greatly feared has come upon me, and that which I was afraid of has come unto me." So what was he afraid of? Well, he was afraid of losing the source of his supposed righteousness. All the great things he had built, all the great things he had done, his status within the nation, within the people. He was fearful of losing all this. So what did God do? He stripped him, literally, of everything and left him sitting on a pile of ashes, covered from the top of his head to the sole of his feet with boils. His best friends, of course, were also an interesting lot. If you've had a trial, a really sore trial, do you think people would walk 300-400 miles to come and help you? Now, they might, but it shows you the influence that Job had with these men. They saw their friend in a mess, and they came, probably at great personal risk in those days, traveling all that distance. And they would probably travel with quite an entourage. But they were very loyal. They didn't understand what was going on, but that's another story. Job had lost all his physical things. He was left with his wife. Even his best friends gave him a rough time, really. And, you know, it's strange, but I think many of us have probably had, I know I've had this, when been going through a particular trial, and somebody says to you, "What is the problem in your life that you're having this great trial? I don't have trials like this." And immediately to me, the warning bells ring, because if people aren't having trials, then maybe God isn't actually working with them. Because, you know, God corrects every son that he loves. Because he's trying to turn our mind from being carnal into what his mind is, holy and perfect. That wisdom that Mr. Monroe was talking about. That's what we're trying to gain now. And as I said the other week, not many wise men now called, but you know, anyone in this room who is baptized and has God's Holy Spirit and has been studying the Bible could go straight into the millennium now and start teaching. Because, you know, the teaching is not difficult, is it? All you've got to do is teach people about the Sabbath, about the holy days, about God's law, and how it all works, link the whole thing to God's plan through the holy days, and you've got the basics of Christian living. It's all there. But you see, fearfulness is horrendous. In fact, just make a note of Revelation 21, verse 8. We've got to save time, you see, otherwise we're going to be late for dinner. Now read, it says, "The fearful and the unbelieving, the fearful and the unbelieving do not make it into the family of God." You see how serious Job's problem was. He was so fearful of losing his self-righteousness, which in God's eyes stinks. And God was looking at him, and yet he had righteousness. He was in contact with God. God was working with him, but God wanted him. God gave him tremendous understanding, as we'll see. But God was working with this man, but he had to knock this out of him. And this epic battle is recorded for our sake, so that we can learn today. You have been, and Job goes on from chapter 4 to chapter 31, defending himself. And 9 times and times and times and times again, he says, "My righteousness I uphold. My righteousness I uphold." And you can just see God saying, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm going to have to sort this one out." But look at the understanding he had. Turn to Job 14, verse 13. Job 13, 14, chapter 14 and verse 13. Job says, "Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would keep me secret until your wrath be past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me." Verse 14, "If a man die, shall he live again?" Very good question. "All the days of my appointed time in the grave, I will wait until my change comes." Change? Change into what? Change into a son of God, to be resurrected. "Then you shall call, and I will answer you, and you will have a desire to the work of your hands." So he realized that he was clay in God's hands, which we all are. So he understood that. He understood that he would be resurrected. He understood that that resurrection would occur at a set time, and that at that resurrection he would be changed. So he obviously understood God's plan. And he understood that he would be speaking to God, and God would be speaking to him. It seems that God had granted him understanding of his great plan for the whole of mankind. He understood the spirit in man. I mean, Job 32, verse 8, you just make a note of it. He says, "But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty gives them understanding." I remember when Mr. Armstrong came up with this one, and we were all stunned. Absolutely stunned. And of course, he tied it in with the two trees, as usual. But when you understand the spirit in man, and you understand God's spirit, and the two together make a complete mind, which is only then capable of absorbing proper wisdom, as Mr. Monroe was talking about. We've got some fantastic people out there today, aren't we? We've got Mr. Hawking, who's this fantastic guy. He's got more letters after his name than you've had hot breakfast recently, right? And he recently came up and said, "I am now convinced that something has been created out of nothing." And everybody nodded and said, "Profound." Profound. And the Federal Reserve said, "He's got it right. We made $16 trillion out of nothing, and nobody said anything." You see, it works. That's what Mr. Monroe was talking about. We are living in a world that is insane. Insane. Their wisdom is warped. This man was wise. But he had a terrible problem. And God had to cut him down to size. And how did he do it? He used what James mentions in James 2:18. He says, "Yea, a man might say, 'You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.' I'll show you what I am, how I think, where I'm going, the direction and the full thrust of my life by what I'm doing." And that's how God faced up Job, as we'll see just now. What did he say to him? "Where were you?" you might have built this great pyramid, yeah? Fantastic, Job. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth, Job? Where were you? Where are the foundations of the earth fastened, Job? Have you worked that one out? Who laid the cornerstone? You couldn't even put a cornerstone on yours. Who laid the cornerstone of the earth? Does the hawk fly with your wisdom?" Have you ever watched a hawk? Up in the Drakensberg, you see these big eagles, and they soar and soar and soar, and all of a sudden they just fold up, and they come down just like greased lightning. You've seen a peregrine falcon? They got one in the middle of London, haven't they, now, that's cleaning up all the pigeons. And it's awe-inspiring. The old pigeons go in there flat out, and this thing comes in like a fighter jet, and just poof, boy, big pile of feathers, one pigeon, lunch. He said, can you make that hawk fly like that? Do you command the wind to blow, Job?" Not much fun in some parts of the world. We've been quite windy where we are at the moment, but I believe in America they're having tornadoes in the middle of winter. "Where does the ice come from, Job? Can you make ice? Can you make hail? Where does the rain come from? Come on, Job, you're a bit slow, lad. Yes? Can you loose the bands of Orion? You might have built the Great Pyramid, but can you move the stars in heaven around? Can you send lightning, Job? Can you number the clouds? Can you provide natural food for the wild birds?" Starting to work with Job, In a modern translation, this is Job 40, verse 2. It says, "Do you still want to argue with the Almighty, or will you yield? Do you, God's critic, have the answers?" This is starting to give us a little bit of an inkling, you see. Job was, frankly, too big for his boots. But, of course, he was so accomplished. He had achieved so many great things. And Job replied to God, "I am nothing. How could I ever find the answers? I lay my hand upon my mouth in silence. I have said too much already." Yeah, you bet, about 20-odd chapters full. And then the Lord spoke to Job again out of the whirlwind. Verse 7, "Stand up like a man, embrace yourself for battle. Let me ask you a question and you give me some answers. Are you going to discredit my justice and condemn me so that you can say you are right?" You look at that. It's getting a little bit close to the bone there, isn't it? "Are you as strong as God? Can you shout as loudly as he? All right then, put on your robes of state, your majesty and your splendor." Bearing in mind, he's sitting on an ash heap with open pussy boils all over his body, racked with pain. Yes. "Give vent to your anger, let it overflow against the proud. Humiliate the haughty with a glance. Tread down the wicked where they stand. Knock them into the dust, stone-faced in death. If you can do that, then I'll agree with you that your strength can save you." And you see, this is getting down to the nitty-gritty. With this self-righteous attitude, he probably felt that he could actually save himself. He was so full of himself, and yet he was a righteous man. And as I said, he was sitting on a heap of ashes, covered in boils. If you've ever had a boil, I had one once, and I never want anything like that again. It was horrendous. Job 42 verse 1, "Then Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do anything and that no thought can be withholden from you." Now that's Be Ye Old English, King James sort of stuff. Let's go to a modern translation. "And then Job replied to the Eternal, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted." And now I think we're getting down to bedrock. "You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I have spoken of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know." Verse 4, "You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you will answer me." Verse 5, "My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Did Job understand God's plan? Well, if he understood about the resurrection, and he understood that it was happening at a set time, and that he understood that he was going to be changed, it sure looks like he had a pretty good idea what was going on. Doesn't it? So why is this recorded for us? If you just make a note of 1 Corinthians 11:31, and the context here is Passover examination, which of course, it's only 8 weeks away. I see Mr. Bowles nodding, and he's just made a note now. Better get some sermons done. Yeah, Passover examination. Do you want to save trials? There is a way. There is a way to cut down on the number of trials we have. And here it is. If we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. We sang the hymn, Psalm 50, the 50 verse Psalm, didn't we? We just sang it this morning. Look at David's attitude. We'll look at David in a minute, but David was a man who thought like God, didn't he? And what was he saying? Purge me of all my... Correct me. He says in another place, protect me from presumptuous sin. Guide my... He was asking God to correct him. And God corrected him. But at the end of the day, he's the only man in the Bible that God turns around and said, that is a man that thinks like I do. A man after my own heart. That's the goal that we're all striving for. And in 2 Corinthians 13:5, talking about examining yourself, the key point to examine yourself on is whether you be in the faith. Now, some years ago, you'd have looked at that and said, well, don't be silly, we're all in the church. But are we in the faith? Do we really believe that God is going to do what he said he was going to do? Because I don't think Job really got that until he went through all these trials, and then he got the point, and then God blessed him. And I'll show you now with a few examples where we're going with that. Now, 1 Corinthians 10:11 is a scripture I think we all know very well. It says, "Now all these things happened to them for examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." If you want to look at it this way, this whole book, 6,000 years of human experience, or 4,000 years of human experience, was written for us. All these people went through all these trials so we could learn from them. And what can we learn? Well, the first thing we can learn is John 6:44, which I'm sure everybody can quote from memory. "No man can come to me except the Father who has sent me draw him." The point is, we very rarely quote the next bit. "And I will raise him up on the last day," on a specific time. That's what Job was talking about. That's part of the promise. We need to understand that with God, all things are possible. Matthew 19, verse 26, make a note of it. I'll give you a real down-to-earth example. We are heading into times which are going to be somewhat tumultuous. Mr. Armstrong, as you saw in the update and read it, he said that when the financial collapse comes, civilization could break down. Last week we were talking about the cities. What's going to happen when the electricity gets cut off? What's going to happen when the trucks can't get in from the supermarket depots to put food in the supermarkets? You're going to have millions and millions of people in cities not being able to get to food, not being able to get to water. And the sewers will back up just to make it a bit more, Not a very pleasant time. Now, we've got people living in some of those cities, particularly in America. How are you going to get to the place of safety? Have you thought about it? Well, you needn't worry about it. Because, see, God's promised there is a place of safety for those who trust him. So just put it out of your mind. If you're going to be there, you'll be there somehow. Not possible? Well, let's have a look at a few examples. Let's look at Noah. Now, have a think about Noah, right? It's obvious that Noah must have had some contact with God, because he was righteous. If he was righteous, he was keeping God's commandments. If he was keeping God's commandments, he had to know them. And he was born 80 years after Enoch died. So the chances are he had to be taught, having to reveal to him again, as, for instance, Mr. Armstrong did. But at some stage, whether Christ, as he became, faced him up face to face, or whether he had a vision or a dream, we don't know. It doesn't tell us. But he appears to Noah and he says, "Look, the whole world is corrupt. It's full of violence. There's no way they're going to come right. So you're the only one I've got that is righteous. You're the only one that's living according to my set of rules. So what I'm going to do is this, Noah. I'm going to destroy the whole world, and I'm going to save you, your wife, and your three sons and their wives." That's it. 8 people. Right? And just think, if you were Noah or his wife, how would you react to that? Right? God's going to wipe out 7 billion people and save just you and your family. Not possible, is it? No. And then, to cap it all, he says, "Well, what you're going to do is you're going to build a little boat. It's going to be roughly 450 foot long, 75 foot wide, 45 foot deep, and you're going to have 3 floors made out of gopher wood, pitched within and without. You've got 100 years to do it, and the whole time you do it, they're going to get mocked. There's people going to throw stones at you. You're going to be all over the television and the newspapers as being the biggest twit on the planet." That's good, isn't it? Does that sound a good idea? And Noah says, and then? He says, then Noah, it's going to rain. And he says, what's rain? Because if you check back, it says that pre-flood, it was that the earth was watered by a mist. That's in Genesis 2, verse 6, if you want to check it out. But Mr. Armstrong said, God's true church knows that only those specially called by God for special purposes have access to him from Adam until now. He says, certainly it is almost without exception that those called did not first seek God. He sought them out and called them. Something was in Noah that God saw again, that he could work with. Noah was not seeking God, but God called Noah to build a great ship on dry land away from the oceans. Noah carried out the assignment amid persecutions and jeers. That was written in Seven Proofs of God's Church, April 79, Plain Truth. Just think about the size of this thing. Probably displaced somewhere around about 30,000, 35,000, 40,000 tons. This is a ship. This is a cruise liner type size ship. It's big. Very, very big. I was talking to Mr. Bowles about this week, and he said, well, that's the point. It's made out of wood. He says, you know, if you lay the keel, by the time you put the top bit on, right at the end of the 100 years, the keel would have rotted. Think about it. So, you know, there's more to this boat than just a wooden hulk. I mean, you come up with all sorts of questions. It only had one window, so how do you light the whole thing? How do you heat the whole thing? How do you feed that bunch of animals for 12 months? How do you get rid of... we won't go down that road. But seriously, you know, these are big problems. This was the culmination of a technical society. Different to ours, they went down a different route to us. But think of it, 1656 years from the creation to the flood, with people living 800-900 years, perfect in body and mind, far sharper probably than we are. They didn't all fall apart by the time they got to 60. And just so you know what happens at 60, Mr. Ian Monroe sent me something that said, if you're 60 years and over and you wake up in the morning and you don't feel sore all over, you're dead. Yes. You read all about this in Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Of course, it's not really like that today, is it? Or is it? Christ said it was. You've only got to read the news and look at the diabolical things. Things that people are asking, questions that people are asking. 2008, right? The Fed bailed out banks around the world to the tune, it now seems, of $16 trillion. Where did it come from? Boom. That easy. They just made it. This is a demented mind. They're now easing. They're now printing money, $85 billion every month, this 12 months, right? And with that, they're buying bonds that banks don't want. They're buying mortgages that the banks want to get rid of. And by the end of this year, the Fed, which is a private company owned by people like the Rothschilds and all that lot, right, will have assets to the value of around about $4 trillion. Tangible assets, not bits of paper. Tangible assets that they can exchange. Right? Evil? Evil, you bet it's evil. You bet it's evil. We have lesbians having children, adopted children. We have men who are living together, adopting children, like Elton John. You know, a lot of jokes in the paper about that, but I don't think it's very funny. We see movies now that are so wretchedly violent and vile that they're altering people's mind. We have people going into schools and shooting children. Earth full of violence? Oh, I think so. I think so. But Noah found grace. Noah found grace. And verse 16, verse 17, and behold, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh wherein is the breath of life from under the heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with you I will establish my covenant, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and their son's wife with thee. Yes, he put them in the ark, and then what? God closed the door. And then they sat there for 7 long days and nights. Can you imagine what that was like? 7 long days. Do you think do you think Noah at any stage there was beginning to look at his wife and saying, "He's shooting another right thing. This is really not working. We're stuck here. Things should be happening." And after 7 days, the rain came. And it would seem the flood wasn't just a matter of soft, gentle rain falling for 40 days and 40 nights. It would seem at that stage that all earth was upheaved. It was violent. And the world that Noah came back to when the water subsided was vastly different. Just trying to see if I can just cut a few little bits out here. Yes, living in a world full of violence, Noah undoubtedly went through many trials and learned that God always delivered on his promises. And this is the key. You know, if any of you want to listen to it, you can go on the internet. Stan Freeberg, is it? Stan Freeberg? And just dial it, just type in Stan Freeberg - Noah, right? And you'll get a comedy skit that he did about Noah and God. Now, it's funny because when you listen to this, you realize how ludicrous it all is. You know how long 100 years is? It's a long time. It's a long time. And for that 100 years he built this boat. Where did he get the wood from? How did he raise the money? Obviously, God obviously provided everything he needed, but the way we look at things, you know, God had to, he had to do, Noah had to do something. Did he have other people working with him? He must have done. It's a tremendous undertaking. Even today, to build a 450-foot boat out of timber would require a whole lot of computers to work out how to do it, because the stresses and strains, I mean, a wooden structure will fall apart under its own weight. Unless it's built properly. It's very, very technical, the ark. And as a matter of interest, the ratio between the length, the width of the beam, and the draft or the depth, right, the ratio today is still the ratio for your ocean-going liner. Length to width to depth is still the same for the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth and so on. And the only ships that break that rule are the giant oil tankers, because they're too long. And they disappear, literally. I read an article about it a while back, and evidently they are so long that in some oceans you get these freak waves of 60, 80, 90, 100 feet high. And the bow goes into the wave, and there's so much water on the front that it pulls the nose of the boat down, and it literally goes straight under. They don't even have time to get an SOS out. There are some strange things, because they're breaking a rule because God gave us the design for a ship. Amazing, isn't it? It's all in the Bible. If you want to build a boat, there's the ratio. Length, width, depth. Now, God chose this man, and he worked with this man. He gave him the craziest of jobs to do in a world that had gone mad, and every single last detail worked out. Not one part of it failed. Not one part of it failed. What do we learn from that? Abraham. You couldn't possibly miss out Abraham in a situation like this, could you? Mr. Armstrong, in that same Plain Truth magazine, April 1979, said, Abraham was not seeking God, but God called him, and without protest or question, he obeyed and went on to become the father of the faithful, to whom the promises of both national birthright of Israel and eternal salvation through Christ were given. See, Abraham believed God. Now, Genesis 17, to turn to Genesis 17. Genesis 17, verse 1. When Abram was 90 years old and 9. So Abram, as he was 99 years old. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be you perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly. And God said to Abram, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah, but Sarah shall her name be, and I will bless her, and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be of her. And Abraham fell on his face and laughed. But God didn't criticize him, because he was laughing for joy. What a promise. What a promise. Because he believed God. And Sarah, your wife, shall bear thee a son indeed, and shall call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. And then Sarah, of course, she was in the tent, and she heard this, and she laughed. And she got corrected, because her laugh was a laugh of total unbelief. And can you ladies feel any feeling for Sarah? You know, she was 90 years old. Now I can look at somebody here who is 90-ish years old. I think if I told her that she was going to have a baby, I think we'd probably still be laughing this time next week. 90 years old, you're going to have a baby. Not only a baby, a son. And that son is going to be the sort of foundation of billions of people. And the Lord said to Abraham, why does Sarah laugh? Saying, surely, of a surety, shall I bear a child? I'm old. And he said, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, you see again, at a specific time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. Is anything too hard for the Lord? That's quite a big question. I said in Genesis 21, verse 1, and the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken, and she conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. So God had obviously said, by next September, you'll have a son. And on the bang date, that's when he was born. Abraham was 100 years old, so that would make Sarah 91. So, but can you imagine, again, bring this down to a human level. Can you imagine what's going on in Abraham's mind? The promise, I will multiply you exceedingly. And he's sitting there and he's 99 years old. And then, of course, in Genesis 22... God appeared to Abraham again, and he said, take now your son, verse 2, your only son Isaac, of the one who you love, and get you into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Whoa, hold on, hang on a second. Now, what do you think about Abraham now? He's now thinking, hang on a second, hold on, I was 99, and he came and he said, you're going to have a son. And then he said, that son is going to be the basis of nations, kings, and all the rest of it. And now he's telling me to sacrifice him? I mean, human sacrifice, I would imagine, was just as big a no-no then as it would be now. And yet in all this, Abraham must have reasoned that God was going to fulfill his promise somehow. Impossible, totally impossible. And you know, to make it, again, as in the situation with Noah, it wasn't a question of just take him round the corner there and do it. He had to go to a specific place for 3 days and two nights. They had to walk. And this lad, who had been in his teens, let's say, walking beside him, his pride and joy, a miracle from God, and they walked, and they had camped for the night, and they got up the next day, and they walked, and they camped for the night. And the third day, they came to the mountain. We can only surmise what actually went on. And what was Isaac's part in all this? I mean, if he was a teenager, and his dad was 115, 16, 17, 18 years old, I think he could have resisted. But there's no record of it. He bound him, he put him on the altar, he got the knife out, and he was starting to get the knife into where it should have been. And God then says, whoa, stop. And what did he say? Now I know you. Now I know you. Now you were even prepared to sacrifice your own son. You know, this is getting onto God territory, isn't it? This is what God the Father had to do with Christ. God the Father had to look down on Christ, hanging on that stake, and turn his back on him. Because he was carrying the sins of the world. And God looked at Abraham, this trial that Abraham had. He was prepared to kill this one and only son that he loved. By then, God knew. And then, of course, the blessings were just poured out, weren't they? The knife was in his hand, the mind made up. And then he said, lay not your hand upon the lad. Neither do you anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son. Then the ram was provided. Now, I don't suppose the ram is very happy about it all, but there you go. It's his fault for being stuck in the thicket. But look at the promises. Genesis 22, verse 17, right? Now, this is where, frankly, this is where it gets to beyond belief, right? This is the blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gates of your enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. We all know what happened. The blessings were withheld. They were withheld for 2,520 years from the time Israel went into captivity. And at 1800, England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales became the United Kingdom. 1800 to 1803, America became properly America. I don't know if you really realize actually what happened with that Louisiana Purchase, but I Googled it. And if any of you children want to do something interesting, Google it and just see what happened, because it is a fascinating story. In a nutshell, 828,000 square miles of territory were purchased by America for 3 cents per acre. Now, if that's not a blessing, I don't know what it was. Even today, that would be around 42 cents an acre today. Anybody want to buy land at 42 cents an acre? Now, what does this really mean, though? 800,000 miles. Here's what it means, folks. Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, parts of Minnesota, west of the Mississippi River, most of North and South Dakota, northeastern New Mexico, northern Texas, portions of Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado east of the Continental Divide, Louisiana west of the Mississippi River, and including New Orleans. And why is New Orleans important? Because New Orleans is at the mouth of the Mississippi River, and that is the M1 of America. That's where everything travels. That is the artery of the center. The whole guts of America flows right down that river. That's why they were panicking a few weeks ago when the level dropped, because the barges were getting in danger of grounding on the bottom. But you see how God's working that one out, because the only way they could relieve that was by letting water out of another river in there to get the level of the Mississippi up. But the problem with that is that where they took the water from, the water was used for irrigation that grows the crops that goes in the barges that come down the Mississippi. Gets a bit complicated, doesn't it? But that might give you some idea as to what the 2 cents an acre worked out at. If you look at a map, it's just basically the whole center, just east of the Rockies, right to the Mississippi, basically, the whole slither of land there. There's tremendous blessing. Britain and America controlled all the main sea gates of the world. The Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, Singapore, Hong Kong, the Cape of Good Hope, and so on. Gibraltar. At the moment, yeah, what have we got left? Not very much. Did God keep his promises over 2,520 years? Yes. Absolutely. And if you want to just throw in the bit with Judah, if you take 2,520 years from the time Judah went down to the exact day, 2,520 years later, General Allenby walked into Jerusalem and relieved it. And all the people who get upset with Bible prophecy point out, but that wasn't the right day, it was a day late. And yes, it was a day late, because they had actually surrendered to a British Army corporal the day before, on the correct day, just to rub insult into injury. When God says something's going to happen, it is going to happen. God also promised that Ephraim and Manasseh, if they did not obey, that he would destroy one third of them in war, one third would die from the resulting famines and disease, and the remainder would go into captivity and have a sword drawn out after them. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I don't think it's very far off. Moses. Again, Mr. Armstrong said, Moses was not seeking God. But God called Moses at the burning bush. He made an excuse protesting the assignment, saying he could not do it because he had an impediment of speech. But God called his brother Aaron to speak for him. God trained Moses through many trials, but God worked with him from birth. But effectively, Moses was called age 80. That's when God called Moses. So I've got another 10 years to go, yeah? That's good. If you think about it, Moses is unique. I mean, he was born, he should have been killed. We all know the story, put into the water. Princess grabs him. Mother then gets roped into being his nurse, which is kind of cool. But Moses grew up to be a great general. Herodotus, the historian, said he was the greatest general that Egypt had ever had. He, like, conquered everything for Egypt, which is very interesting. But at age 40, they had the aberration when he jumped in to stop this Hebrew being killed. And then he had to run for it. And then he spent 40 years up in the hills, up in the wilderness, chasing his father-in-law's sheep. Now, that would have built some character. I see one or two people who have had sheep here grimacing. Yes. The only good sheep to me is one that's meat. They have an evil glint in their eye. And if you think they're bad, look at a goat. And then, of course, he has now trained this man. This man is now used to moving people around. He's used to fighting battles. And with hundreds of thousands of people. So he knew how to control. He didn't have an iPod and an iPad. Yeah? He had to kind of like use basic things like trumpets and probably waving flags around, I don't know. How do you control 2 million, 2.5 million people? They marched out of Egypt by rank. He organized them like the military because that's how he was trained. But God trained him. He had to be a very special man. But again, one man was called. So Exodus 3 verse 10, he says, this is God talking to Moses. Come now therefore, and I will send you unto Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. No major problem there. Except for the fact that Pharaoh perhaps wouldn't be kind of like too keen to lose his bread and butter, because the Israelites... To the Egyptians, farming was the lowest of the lowest of the lowest job. And nothing's really changed because today it's regarded as more or less the same. Except that when the food stops coming from the farms, people might change their opinion a little bit. But yeah, farming's not really a very popular sport these days. Bankers, on the other hand, that's a cool job. You can make a mess, wreck the bank, and still get paid a bonus the next year. That's pretty good. But Moses, of course, wasn't too keen on this idea. Verse 11 of Exodus 3. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? I mean, I'm looking after the sheep. And God said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be a token unto you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. And Moses said unto God, behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they shall say to me, what's his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shall you say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. So Moses is sort of starting to get the point. But it goes on and on, and Christ, we call him Christ because that's what he is now. He says, but I am sure, verse 19, and I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall come to pass that when you go, you shall not go empty. For every woman shall borrow of her neighbor and of her and of her that sojourns in her house, jewels of silver, jewels of gold and raiment. And you shall put them upon your sons and upon your daughters. And you shall spoil the Egyptians. So after 430 years, you're going to leave Egypt and you're going to be filthy, stinking rich. Right, look at the promises here, right? Here's a man who's herding sheep up on the hill who's going to go to the power at that time, like America has been today, right? And he's going to take roughly 2 to 3 million people who are the backbone of the country. They're producing basically most of the food for the nation, and he's going to take those people out from underneath that country away, and then this God that's been speaking to him says he's going to trash this great nation, the world's superpower. Now think of these, you put these all into context, and poor old Moses is standing there sort of keeping half an eye on his sheep and wondering what's quite going on here. Me? I can't even speak properly. I got a stutter or whatever he had. And he made every excuse to get out of it. Because why? It looked like a comic book story to him. He was going to go to Egypt and get these people out and then stand there while God trashed the whole of Egypt. Because God hadn't told him about the sea and parting the sea and all the other things that were going to happen. He hadn't also told him what was going to happen. The minute they got out the other side, they'd totally forget all this lot and start moaning and whinging. That again is another story. And then you go on through, and Moses is then moaning and groaning against him. Oh, I can't really do this. How can I do this? And the Lord said to him, this is Exodus 4, verse 2. What have you got in your hand? And he said, well, it's a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled before it. And the Lord said to Moses, put forth your hand and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. Now, I think if that had happened to any of us, we would kind of like get the point that there was like something going on here. Maybe, possibly, just perhaps. But no. That they may believe, verse 5, that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared unto you. And the Lord said furthermore to him, now put your hand in your bosom. And he put his hand in his bosom, and when he pulled it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. So he stuck his hand around his coat, pulled it out, and it was leprous. Now, I don't know if you've seen anybody with leprosy. I've only seen photographs of it. It is the most ghastly, horrendous thing. It chows away lumps of flesh. It is vile. It really is just the pits. And he says, now you put it back in again. And he put his hand in again, he pulled it out, and it was back to normal again. Now, surely anybody like us, if we saw anything, if God produced that with us, I think we kind of like get the point that, okay, it's got to happen, right? But you know, just as big a miracle has happened with us, because God's taken us out of this world, and he's put his spirit in us, and we've got a future ahead of us, which is unbelievable. And of course it involves all these people as well. But after all these signs, he still didn't get it. And he said, I'm not eloquent of speech, chapter 4, verse 10. You know, I'm slow of speech and a slow tongue. So obviously it is some kind of impediment. And of course, God got angry at him and he said, all right, we'll get Aaron and your brother. Interesting, the family got back together again, isn't it? Because his sister and his brother. And the rest, as they say, is history. And yet, Moses himself went through all that. He went through all the plagues, including the firstborn. And keep in mind, it wasn't just the firstborn of people. It was the firstborn of animals as well. And what animals were left after all the other 9 plagues? Egypt was in total chaos. Absolute total chaos. And Moses then led the people out. They got to this impasse where they had the fire, the pillar of cloud and fire and stuff behind them. They were hemmed in on both sides by mountains, and the sea was before them. And God said, "Light, lift your hands up." And they lifted his hands up, and the sea just parted. And the wind blew, and the bottom of the sea dried up, and they marched through. And then, to make it really more graphic, they stood on the other side, and the Egyptians come roaring through. And not content with just crushing them, God first of all removed all the wheels from the chariots. You can read that in the account. Yeah, and the Egyptians said, "Oops, the God of Israel is fighting us." Hey, hey, got the point. Crunch. See you in the resurrection. And Moses is sitting there, standing there, watching all this. Keep all this in mind as we go along. And then for 40 long years, they're up and down and through the desert, and mainly in the area of Petra and Kadesh and so on. All the experiences he had there. And it, right at the end, if you go to Numbers 20, Numbers 20, verse 7. This, one level, this is a downer, right? But it's also very, very encouraging from our points, because we all goof, don't we? We all have little aberrations, shall we call them, from time to time. And we've got to pick ourselves up and sort ourselves out and keep on going. Here's this man Moses, Numbers 20, verse 7. "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Take your rod," they're all moaning again because there was no water, "and gather the assembly together, you and Aaron your brother, and speak unto the rock before their eyes." You see, this is the instruction, and this is something where we can perhaps, you know, learn a little bit from. Speak unto the rock, specific command, "and it will bring forth water. And you shall bring forth to them water out of the rock, so you shall give the congregation and their beasts to drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Eternal, as he had commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he lost it." Basically. "Here now, you rebels, must we fetch water from this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly, and the congregation and the beasts and they drank. But just for that minute, it was too much, wasn't it? And we all get to that stage. You just want to blow. And the pressure just gets just too much, and you just want to... This is what happened. Moses, after all this, was very human. He's also pushing 120 years old. "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, and says, Because you believe me not to sanctify me, to separate me apart before this congregation of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." Ouch. That hurt. That would have been a real crushing disappointment. "This is the water at Meribah, because the children of Israel strove with the Eternal, and he was sanctified in them." But you know, we know Moses has made it. Because the transfiguration is Moses and Elijah, wasn't there? So you see, in spite of the fact that we make mistakes, if we repent and we keep going, we make it. The promise is all here, but it's all in the events of other people's lives that we can learn. As Paul said, they're examples. They happen to them so that we can learn now. And it's a tremendous way of learning. Joseph. Here's another one. You get the impression of Joseph that he was... I don't know. He had the knack, perhaps, of winding up his brothers. You got the impression he was almost daddy's little pet. You know, he made a special coat for him and so forth and so on. And there was obviously like aggro between them. Interesting, the aggro still was basically between the children today. You know, we have, especially France, for some reason, it's Reuben, yeah. Still comes in for the butt of a lot of jokes. But Joseph, they want to get rid of him. So they chuck him down the pit. They take his coat, put some blood on it. and take that back to the father and say, oh, he looks like he's dead. There's his coat. That's what we found, kind of thing. Meanwhile, they sold him. So here's poor old Joseph now, taken down to Egypt to be sold. Can you imagine being sold? Like a bag of potatoes. You know, you're lined up, oh, I'll have this one, I'll have that one. You know. But he goes into Potiphar's house and very quickly proves himself to be very astute, very reliable, very pleasant, and very obedient. And Potiphar is very impressed and says, run my house. And he was a nice, young, strong, good-looking lad. And Potiphar's wife thought, well, I'll have a bit of this. And Joseph, of course, wasn't about to go down that road because he was godly. And he fled. And in fleeing, of course, he only dropped his cloak even. Read the story. And of course, this all came to a head and he got slung in jail. And he was in jail for a long time. And Genesis 40, we pick the story up. And verse 8 of verse Genesis 40. And they said to him, we have dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter for it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, I pray you. And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph, and said to him, in my dream, behold, a vine was before me. And in the vine were three branches. And it was as though it was budded, and her blossom shot forth, and the clusters thereof brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head and restore you to your place, because he was in the jail along with Joseph, and you shall deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner when you were his butler. But think of me when it shall be well with you, and show kindness, I pray, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. You can just imagine him, can't you? Hey, God's just given me this interpretation. This guy's going to get off scot-free. He's going to have right next to Pharaoh, giving Pharaoh his glass of wine. He's got Pharaoh's ear. Surely he'll say something. No. 2 long years later, Genesis 41 verse 1, and it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. And we haven't got time to go through all this, otherwise the 7 years of plenty won't be on the table in time. But you know the story. Pharaoh had the dream. And there was, and Joseph, God gave Joseph the interpretation of the dream. Interesting that he said, verse 14, Genesis 41, verse 14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came before Pharaoh. In other words, he was made presentable before he was brought before Pharaoh. And then they had this thing with the dream. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, this is verse 39 now of chapter 41, for as much as God has shown you all this, therefore none so discreet and wise as you, she had godly wisdom, yes, you shall be over my house, and according unto your word shall all my people be ruled, only in the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I have set you over the whole land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. So poor old Joe started the morning with an iron chain around his waist and ended up the day with a gold chain around his neck. Impossible? Yep. Did it happen? Yes. And Joseph was 30 years old before he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. You see, in the beginning, Joseph was a lad that God was going to work with, but Joseph had problems. He wasn't getting on with his brothers, obviously, because they wanted to get rid of him. So maybe he was a kind of stroppy young lad and needed the strop knocking out of him. And God worked with him, and it looked like it probably went on, I don't know, 10 years more. And at the end of it, what does he do? He's literally king of Egypt. And not just that, but over the 14-year period, They go crazy the first 7 years and store everything up. And the last 7 years, he sells it back to the people. First of all, for money. I mean, the money runs. You can read the story. The money runs out. He says, okay, fine. Well, your cattle. So they kind of like pledge all their cattle for more food. And then they pledge all their land to more food. And then eventually they pledge their own bodies for food. So at the end of the 14-year period, Pharaoh owned Egypt, lot, stock and barrel, from the people to the animals to the land, the lot. Pharaoh owned everything. Joseph made him rich. Very interesting story. Impossible. And then even, it gets even more impossible because you can read the story where the whole family then came back together. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. I've just written here, impossible. It happened. It happened. From iron chain to gold chain in a few hours. Can God change our lives? Is God capable of taking us to a place of safety when the whole world is falling apart? Can he chuck us out in the wilderness for 3.5 years and sustain us? Well, he said he can. Do we believe him? As we examine ourselves, are we of the faith? Do we really believe God's going to do it? Because that's the key. That was the key for these men. And we've got time for one more. We're going to look at David. Because David's a kind of special case. 1 Samuel 16, verse 1. And the Eternal appears to Samuel and says, how long will you mourn for Saul? Remember, Samuel was given the job when Israel rejected God's rule of choosing Saul. And Saul was head and shoulders above everybody. He was an Andy Munro plus 3 inches. He was big. He was a good looking guy. Everybody liked Saul. He was fantastic. But Saul had a problem. Saul had a problem. When it came to, push came to shove, Samuel told him, you wait until I come. Yeah? You wait until I come. And I will offer the sacrifice. And then Samuel backed off and just waited to see what happened. And what happened? Got a bit close to the line, and then Saul decided that he would take over. He took over a job that was not his. And he rejected, basically, God's rule. God rejected him. So the Lord came to Samuel and said, how long will you mourn? This is 1 Samuel 16, verse 1. Seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel, fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. For I have provided me a king among his sons. Note this. I have provided me a king. This is God speaking. So he had selected the person. And we know the story. Samuel goes in. All the big stropping strands. Two big lads are all there. Oh, no, not him. No, not him, not him. Gone through all the sons. Is that it? No. There's one more. The rut. He's up in the field. They're looking after sheep. Well, let's have him in. And we're going back. What are we going back to? We're going back to a shepherd. We're going back to what Moses was doing. Same job. David said in one place he invested with a bear and a lion. So he was a pretty strong lad. But think of it. Put yourself into David's shoes. They come running up the hill and says, your dad wants you now. How often have we heard that one? And you run like mad into the house out of breath. And there's Samuel. Now you've only ever seen Samuel like twice. And you kind of like, you know, this guy is so important that as a kid you don't even be near him. I remember one little girl who, when the ministers came to do a visit, that she ran and hid in the toilet. And to help her along with her problems, I married her. You know, when you're only tiny and these two great big Americans come in and you've never seen an American before. Mr. McNair, I believe, was one of them. But you can imagine, here's David hauled up, and here's Samuel. Ah! And Samuel says, come here, boy. Pours the oil over his head, puts his hand on him. I'm anointing you in God's name. You're king of Israel. And what was he, maybe 18 years old? What did he think? What did his brothers think? And his mum and dad? And Samuel says, okay, I've done your job. I'm out of here. And he's off like a dirty shirt. And there's David left standing there with the oil still running off his head, king of Israel. Half an hour before, he'd been up the hill with his slingshot and some Coca-Cola cans on the wall, trying to knock them off, yeah? And he's just been anointed king of Israel. And look what he went through. Look what he went through. Several years, maybe 10, 12 years, going, he got called into Saul, he was strumming on his harp, and because don't forget, when the Spirit of God went on to David, it left Saul. Not only did it leave Saul, but if you read the account, a wicked spirit replaced it. So now we have a totally unbalanced mind. This is what happens, for instance, with the beast and the false prophet. A wicked spirit will enter into them. At first, they'll look like normal human beings. The beast will probably look like a good leader. But suddenly, you know, it'll enter, and he'll just change. We all saw Saddam Hussein strutting around there, issuing his orders. And yet when they found him in the hole, he was a shell. The spirit had left him. He was just a hulk. So David had a rough time with Saul, and several times was given opportunity to kill him. And let's be honest, if you had been anointed king of Israel, picture it, you're sitting in this cave, you're hiding behind a rock, and literally within touching distance is Saul doing the necessary, and you've got a nice big sharp knife, you could just reach around that rock and let him have it. You've been anointed king by Samuel, yeah? God has anointed you king of Israel. So, take the throne. No. Not David. I will not touch the Lord's anointed. What he was saying basically is, I've been anointed king, yes, but I'll be king when God sorts this guy out. And that's the way it went. And we all know, David's life is probably one of the most catalogued lives in the Bible. We see all his sins laid bare for us. He even, the sin with Bathsheba. In 1 Kings 15 verse 5, just make a note of it. You know, God says he'll remove our sins for us, he'll forget them. And yet with David, he says, because David did that which was right in the eyes of the Eternal and turned not aside from anything that he had commanded him all the days of his life. Right? What an accolade. Read the next bit. Save only in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. That is a horrendous. Because what he did then was horrendous. And one day we might actually look into what happened there, because this whole story would make a news story for today. Oh, the papers would love it. It involves Ahithophel, it involves the young lady herself, and it wasn't all as clean cut as it looked. It was actually somebody else trying to pull strings in the government. Ahithophel thought that if his daughter married the king, that he would then be in there and control things. And then when it didn't work with David, he put his lot in with Absalom. But that's again another story for another day. But Acts 13 verse 22 gives us the end result. Acts 13 verse 22. And it says, and when he had removed him, he raised up to them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who shall fulfill all my will. Of this man's seed hath God, according to his promise, raised unto Israel a Saviour, Jesus. Again, another promise. It took hundreds of years. David was reigning round about 900-ish AD. 1000 to 900 AD. In that sort of area was David and Solomon. Easy way to remember dates. David and Solomon ran about 1000 BC. Sorry. Abraham, 2000 BC. It's more or less on the 1000-year mark. Very interesting that. But what an example to lead. And again, it was another promise, you see, that Christ would come out of the house of David. And that was only fulfilled 800, 900 years later. See, to God, it's only a day or two. It's not long. So 2520 years, 900 years, it doesn't matter. If God makes a promise, it will be carried out to the letter. So as I said in the introduction, if you're falling down the well and the rope's frayed and you're hanging on, no, it's not a time to jump up and down and say you're going to really, really enjoy this trial. I've never enjoyed a trial yet. But it's a time to look back, because we've all had them, and we've had some Lulus at times. And you look back and you look what you learned, and you look at the changes that it brought about in your life, and you can see that God is working with you, so you can project it on. As long as you keep on going in the same trajectory, you'll get to where God wants you to be, to where you can leave your shoes behind. Meet Christ in the air. Or if we die beforehand, be resurrected. You get the bonus then, you get it to go first. Even that detail is in the Bible. The dead rise first. Then we that are still alive... Oh, see, Paul got that wrong. Oh, can we believe anything Paul wrote? They say, that we that are alive, we'll be changed. I'd like to be changed. Somebody's going to have that experience. It would be nice. No, we don't enjoy those trials. But if you just make a note of Matthew 24, verse 12, 13, because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that shall endure unto the end. Endure what? Endure everything that God puts on us as trials, and that the world throws at us, and that frankly Satan throws at us as well. That's why we're told every day to pray that God would rescue us from Satan. Think of what Satan said, right, with Job again. God said to him, yeah, well, you see my servant Job? He's cool. And Satan says, yeah, of course he is. You put a fence around him, I can't get at it. That's what we want to pray for, people. We want the fence. We want that hedge about us that Satan can't get at us. Because we are the ones he wants to destroy more than any one thing on this planet at the moment. The people of God, wherever they are, scattered around this earth, are what Satan wants to destroy. Then John 6:44, no man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up in the last day. That's every bit as much of a valid promise as to Moses, go in and do your job, I'll trash Egypt, and I'll bring you and the people out, and you'll be safe. Oh, and for an encore, I'll rip the sea apart just to give you a grand exit. It happened, so we can be sure that when God makes a promise, he makes a promise. And when we're thinking about Passover, it's a thought that came to me. You know, in Malachi 3:18, we read that scripture quite regularly. It says, and you shall return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. Isn't that what the scripture was talking about? You know, about examining ourselves? In other words, we learn to discern ourselves. Because if we're honest, apart from God, we're the only person that knows what's really going on in here. You're the only person that really knows your motives. What's going on in your head? Why are you doing things? Why did something go wrong? So if we learn to discern our own problems and ask God to help us change where we see things that aren't right, it makes our life a lot easier. And let's be honest, if a child comes to a father and says, Dad, I've got an awful problem with this particular whatever, can you help me? Is that not much easier to work with somebody like a child like that than one that's continually creating the problem and you've got to try and beat it out of him? It's much easier if the child comes and says, look, I've got a problem, I need help. I can't sort this wherever it is. We're no different. We're just children in God's eyes. So basically, when we have been through many different trials and we have seen God rescue us every time, and that's what we used to think in terms of, is think of what's happened in your life, all of us. Go back and look at the times when you've been in a right mess, and look how God worked it out, in spite of us, in many cases. In spite of us. And he will continue to do this, in spite of us. And then we can know that God's promises are sure as long as we are living God's way.